19. We forked right at the sign for Middle Boar and headed east along a dusty road that ran parallel to a rocky escarpment. The road rose and fell through a thicket of grey-leaved bushes, and there were pale hawks perching on the fence posts. Arkady kept swerving to avoid the deeper ruts. Not far to the right, we passed an outcrop of weathered sandstone with freestanding pinnacles about 20 feet high. I knew it had to be a dreaming sight. I nudged Big Tom in the ribs. "Who's that one?" I asked.
"Him a small one."
He cricked his index finger to imitate a wriggling grub.
"Witchetty?"
He shook his head strenuously and, with the gesture of feeding a grub into his mouth, said,
"Smaller one."
"Caterpillar?"
"Yeah,"
he beamed and nudged me back. The road ran on towards a white house in a clump of trees, with a spread of buildings beyond it. This was Middle Boar Station. There were chestnut horses grazing in a field of bone-white grass. We veered left along a smaller track, crossed a watercourse and stopped at the gate of my second Aboriginal camp. The place had a less woebegone look than Skull Creek. There were fewer broken bottles, fewer festering dogs, and the children looked far healthier. Although it was late in the afternoon, most of the people were still asleep. A woman sat sorting bush tucker under a tree, and when Arkady greeted her, she looked down and stared at her toes. We picked our way past the humpies, zigzagging through clumps of spinifex, towards the wheelless body of a Volkswagen van. There was a green tarpaulin stretched over the door, and a length of plastic hose dribbled into a patch of watermelon. Chained to the van was the usual sharp-muzzled hound.
"Alan," Arkady raised his voice above the yapping.
No reply.
"Alan, are you there?" "Crust," he said under his breath. "Let's hope he's not off again."
We waited a while longer, and a long black hand appeared around the edge of the tarpaulin. This was followed, after an interval, by a wiry, silver-bearded man wearing a pale grey Stetson, dirty white pants, and a purple shirt printed with guitars. He was barefoot. He stepped into the sunlight, looked clean through Arkady, and majestically lowered his head. The dog continued to bark, and he walloped it. Arkady talked to him in Walbiri. The old man listened to what he had to say, lowered his head a second time, and retired back behind the tarpaulin.
"Reminds me of Haile Selassie," I said as we walked away. "But grander."
"Much grander," I agreed. "He will come, won't he?"
"I think so."
"Can he speak any English?"
"Can, but won't. English isn't his favourite language."
The Katij, Arkady told me, had had the misfortune to live along the route of the Overland Telegraph line, and so came early into contact with the white man. They also learned to make knives and spear points from the glass conductors, and, to put a stop to this practice, it was thought necessary to teach them a lesson. The Katij took revenge on their murderers. Earlier in the afternoon, we had passed on the roadside the grave of the telegraph operator who, in 1874, dying of a spear thrust, succeeded in tapping out a farewell message to his wife in Adelaide. The police reprisals dragged on until the 1920s. Alan, as a young man, had seen his father and brothers gunned down.
"And you say he's the last one left?" "Of his clan," he said, "in this stretch of country."
We were sitting back to back against the trunk of a gum tree, watching the camp come alive. Mavis and Ruby had gone visiting their women friends. Big Tom had dozed off, and Timmy sat cross-legged, smiling. The ground was parched and cracked, and a solid, undeviating stream of ants was passing within inches of my boots.
"Where the hell is Marion?" Arkady said abruptly. "Should have been here hours ago. Anyway, let's get some tea."
I dragged some brushwood from the thicket and lit a fire while Arkady unpacked the tea things. He passed a ham roll to Timmy, who gobbled it up, asked for another, and, with the air of a man accustomed to being waited on by servants, handed me his billy to fill. The water was almost boiling when, all of a sudden, there was a tremendous hullabaloo in the camp. Women shrieked, dogs and children scuttled for cover, and we saw, hurtling towards us, a column of purplish-brown dust. The willy-willy roared and crackled as it approached, sucked up leaves, branches, plastic, paper and scraps of metal sheet, spiralling them into the sky, and then sweeping across the campground and on towards the road. A moment or two of panic, and everything was back to normal. After a while, we were joined by a middle-aged man in a sky-blue shirt. He was hatless. The stiff grey bristles on his head were the length of the bristles on his chin. His frank and smiling face reminded me of my father's. He squatted on his hams and shoveled spoons full of sugar into his mug. Arkady talked. The man waited for him to finish and answered in a low whisper, doodling diagrams in the sand with his finger. Then he walked away, in the direction of Alan's living van. "Who was he?" I asked.
"The old man's nephew," he said, "and also his ritual manager."
"What did he want?"
"To check us out."
"Did we pass?"
"I think we can expect a visit."
"When?"
"Soon."
I wish I understood this business of ritual manager.
"It's not easy."
The smoke from the fire blew in our faces, but at least kept away the flies. I took out my notebook and propped it on my knee. The first step, Arkady said, was to get to grips with two more Aboriginal expressions, Kurda and Kutangerlu. Old Alan was Kurda, that is to say, he was the owner or boss of the land we were going to survey. He was responsible for its upkeep, for making sure its songs were sung and its rituals performed on time. The man in blue, on the other hand, was Alan's Kutangerlu, his manager or helper. He belonged to a different totemic clan and was a nephew, real or classificatory. That didn't matter, on Alan's mother's side of the family. The word Kutangerlu itself meant uterine kin. "So the manager," I said, "always has a different dreaming to the boss."
"He does."
Each enjoyed reciprocal rights in each other's country and worked as a team to maintain them. The fact that boss and manager were seldom men of the same age meant that ritual knowledge went ricocheting down the generations. In the old days, Europeans believed the boss was really boss and the manager some kind of sidekick. This, it turned out, was wishful thinking. Aboriginals themselves sometimes translated Kutangerlu as policeman, which gave a far more accurate idea of the relationship.
"The boss," said Arkady, "can hardly make a move without his policeman's permission. Take the case of Alan here. The nephew tells me they're both very worried the railway's going to destroy an important dreaming site, the eternal resting place of a lizard ancestor, but it's up to him, not Alan, to decide if they should come with us or not."
The magic of the system, he added, was that responsibility for land resides ultimately not with the owner, but with a member of the neighbouring clan.
"And vice versa?" I asked. "Of course."
"Which would make war between neighbours rather difficult."
"Checkmated," he said.
"It'd be like America and Russia agreeing to swap their own internal politics."
"Shh," Arkady whispered. "They're coming."